Good morning, everyone. I will start the recording and we'll start with the first article. I will share my screen. So this is an article by Gorbekon and colleagues from the University of Hamburg Eppendorf, and it's entitled Prevalence of MTAP Deficiency in Human Cancer, a Tissue Microarray Study on 13,067 Tumors from 149 Different Tumor Types, published in American Journal of Surgical Pathology. So, as you probably know, loss of expression of MTAP or homozygous deletion is now approved by the FDA for clinical trials of MTAP-targeted therapies. And the gene encoding MTAP is adjacent to CDKN2A and chromosome 9p21.3. And we know that because we use it as a surrogate marker for homozygous deletion of CDKN2A to identify malignancy in mesothelioma. And so this study aimed to profile loss of MTAP expression across various tumors to evaluate its diagnostic utility and potential for targeted therapy. They used TMAs. They only used one core per case, and the core was 0.6 millimeter in greatest dimension. For the IHC for MTAP, they used clone MSVA-741R. I had not heard of that clone. Must be one of the newer clones, I don't know. And they did validate it with the more common clone 2G4 on benign tissue. They did require a positive internal control for each case to be counted as or to be included in the study. They also did IHC for PD-L1, but they did not provide the clone, and they did IHC for CD8. They performed FISH for MTAP using the probe 9p21, and that probe includes not only MTAP but also the CDKN2A gene, and they performed it in cases with loss of MTAP expression. So as the title says, they included over 13,000 tumor samples from 149 different tumor types and 76 non-neoplastic tissue types. They showed MTAP loss, which is in table one for all the tumors. If we go down here, there are all the tumors here, and the column, which is entitled 0%, is actually the MTAP loss. They found it in 7.1% of all the tumors they tested, and this was 55% of all tumor types. It was most common, actually, lost in Hodgkin lymphoma, with 50% of Hodgkin lymphoma showing loss of MTAP expression. Also, up to 80% of neuroendocrine tumors of various sites, and then in mesotheliomas, between 32 and 37%. They found homozygous deletion in 90% to 100% of the cases with loss of MTAP expression for several of the cancers. And that's actually really nicely illustrated in figure four. So all the red is where MTAP loss correlates with homozygous deletion on 9P. The blue is where they show MTAP loss, but there was no deletion. And the yellow is where there was MTAP loss and heterozygous deletion of 9P. So what I found interesting is that a lot of these tumor types have MTAP loss, but not the homozygous deletion of 9P. So there must be some
Anya,
other.
can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
So which predicts for response to the therapy?
So according to the FDA, it's MTAP loss or the homozygous deletion. So if you have MTAP loss, you can use it.
Okay.
So IHC is good enough. And actually, what this indicates is that there must be some other mechanisms that leads to loss of MTAP expression, such as hypermethylation of the promoter. What I also found interesting is they performed some association of MTAP loss with clinical with clinical features. So, for instance, in hepatocellular carcinomas, they found that MTAP loss was associated with lymph node metastasis and high grade. In neuroendocrine tumors, they found it associated with advanced PT stage. In squamous cell carcinomas, they found MTAP loss associated with high grade, with advanced PT stage and absence of HPV. And also, MTAP expression or loss of MTAP expression was associated with PD-L1 expression and fewer CD8 positive lymphocytes, which they thought is likely responding or likely associated with a poor immune response. So overall, what does the paper tell us? Loss of MTAP expression is present in multiple cancer types. So multiple cancer types may be potential for targeted therapy with MTAP-targeted therapies. Also, this paper again says that loss of MTAP expression is not useful in the distinction between mesothelioma and metastatic disease. Besides homozygous deletion, as I said, there must be other mechanisms that may result in loss of MTAP expression. What the critique on this paper, I have to say, is using TMA. I always have some concerns about it. And in this TMA specifically, they only used one tissue spot per tumor, which is only 0.6 millimeter. So there is no way to say anything about potential heterogeneity of expression. Any questions offset to that paper?
Hey, Anya, this is Andreas. So we use MTAP in mesotheliomas to differentiate between benign and malignant. You think it has any use in other tumors?
Well, that's a great question. They did not go into that. But based on thymic tumors, I mean, we looked into that. We only found it in thymic carcinomas, not in thymomas. Whatever that was. But I'm not aware of any other studies that looked into benign versus malignant. I don't know if anyone else has any other
Anya, does
experience.
the FDA stipulate which clone has to be used to be able to use
No.
their drug? So
No.
if our oncologist asks for an MTAP stain, we can do whatever we validated in our laboratory.
You can accept. This is now a predictive marker, so you have to make sure that you actually validated 20 positive and 20 negative cases. Because we
Okay.
have to revalidate our MTAP to make sure that we have 20 positive and 20 negative cases.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also interesting about these clones. I think most of us probably used the 2G4. That was the first clone that was found to be really good working. But then there was this recent paper from the MSK group, which we I think had discussed here, and they found the clone 1819 to be better interpretable, although they had not compared it to 2G4. They compared it to some other clone. And I actually asked Andy Chirk, and he had switched to the clone 1819, and we are switching to that one too. It's a little bit more easier to read, but doesn't make a huge difference, I would say. Sometimes MTAP can be a little difficult to read. But anyway.
So Anya, is this drug specific for a tumor, or is it just for MTAP deletion?
It's just for any solid tumor with
Wow.
MTAP deletion, and it's only in clinical trials, although I think people also start to use that besides clinical trials, because we had the request to,
Yeah.
but yeah, I don't know. But they do not specify any, they do not specify any specific clone.
And this paper showed that MTAP is not a good surrogate in mesothelioma. You still
No,
need to
no, no,
look
no,
for
no, no,
the
no, no.
gene deletion.
No. It does not go into mesothelioma. All what I'm saying is that we cannot use loss of MTAP expression as a distinguisher between mesothelioma and metastatic disease, because a lot of other tumors show MTAP, loss of
Oh,
MTAP
I
expression.
see.
Yeah, that's
But
the only
when it
thing.
comes to
Yeah.
mesothelioma versus carcinoma, it's still useful. It,
No,
it's
not versus
still.
carcinoma. It's useful for malignant versus
Sorry.
reactive.
Sorry. Yes, that's what I meant to say. Sorry. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Thank you.
They did not, they did not actually go into that.
And did they look at sarcomatoid versus epitheliomatous
no.
types of
meso?
I
don't think they distinguish between that.
Yeah.
But I would have to go back. Yeah.
They have biphasic up there, but you don't know
do
which.
They?
Yeah, I just noticed that, but so you don't know what part of the tumor showed loss.
Yeah. So actually they didn't even do sarcomatoid meses. Only biphasic, yeah. You're right, Henry. All right. So if there are no more questions, then let's go to the next paper. This is for everyone who actually has to evaluate anything with lung transplantation or who's just interested in lung transplantation. This is from Renaud Picard and colleagues from the Toronto group, and it's entitled Spectrum of Chronic Lung Allograft Dysfunction Pathology in Human Lung Transplantation. It was published in the Journal of Heart and Lung Transplantation. And we do know that chronic lung allograft dysfunction, or CLAD, is the main limitation to long-term survival in lung transplantation. There are four subtypes of CLAD, which had been outlined in the 2019 ISHLT guidelines. The most common is probably BOS, or the bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome, followed by RAS, which is the restrictive allograft syndrome. And BOS, we know morphologically as bronchiolitis obliterans. RAS, morphologically, we typically see what looks like pleuroparenchymal fibroelastosis or intraalveolar fibroelastosis. But sometimes you can also see diffuse alveolar damage, organizing pneumonia, or even bronchiolitis obliterans. And then there is the mixed subtype and the undefined subtype. This study was aimed to study the morphologic spectrum of CLAD and to evaluate a semi-quantitative morphologic grading system that was developed in mice. So let's compare the human with mice in this study. And they included explants for retransplantation from 20 end-stage CLAD patients. And they also included 13 non-transplant control lungs. The CLAD phenotype was adjudicated by two clinicians for each patient. And that was done basically on pulmonary function tests and fibrosis-like opacities on imaging. They used these explanted lungs, and they got their sections from four locations, including one peripheral section and one central section from each location. And the location was right upper lung, two times left upper lung, and one times left lower lung. So they did not sample the right lower lung or the right middle lung. Their histopathologic grading system was based on scores, and just to illustrate that, it's in table one because it's a quite extensive scoring system. They had for histologic features over 10 features, which is here on the left column. And then for each features, they had usually a score of 0 through 4, so 5 different scores, except for a few which had a little bit less scores. And if you want to see the scoring on morphology, there is this figure here. So basically what they scored was peri-airway fibrosis, bronchiolitis obliterans, which is basically the C grade of the ISHLT scoring, epithelial hyperplasia, epithelial flattening, peri-airway inflammation, parenchymal fibrosis, pleural fibrosis, lymphoid aggregates, endotheliitis, vascular fibrosis, which is essentially the grade D for the ISHLT grading. And then they also graded the rejection grades A and B, and they performed a few IF staining, so immunofluorescence staining. In their cohort, they had 12 bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome cases, 7 restrictive allograft syndrome cases, and 1 mixed case based on the clinical assessments. The patients in the control group, so this were these non-transplant controls, were a bit older, but there was no difference in the patient characteristics between the BOS group and the RAS group. The inter-rater agreement for all of these histologic features was either good or excellent. And then the most of the histologic features were higher scored in both BOS and RAS when compared to controls, but there was no difference in the scoring between BOS and RAS. And that included the peri-airway fibrosis, the bronchiolitis obliterans, the pleural fibrosis, the epithelial hyperplasia, the epithelial flattening, the peri-airway inflammation, the A and B grades, and the number of lymphoid aggregates. There were a few histologic features that were higher scored in RAS than BOS and control, and this included pleural fibrosis, which was, parenchymal fibrosis, which was also quite heterogeneous within RAS and often included intraalveolar fibroelastosis and diffuse septal fibrosis. And also endotheliitis and vascular fibrosis was higher scored in RAS than BOS. So basically what the manuscript concludes is that BOS and RAS are not separate entities, but probably the ends of a spectrum of histologic findings. Also, RAS, as expected, is more associated with parenchymal and vascular fibrosis, and BOS predominantly shows bronchiolar fibrosis. Now, what I would say as a critique to this paper is they would like to have this histopathologic scoring system to evaluate CLAD progression. And I think it may be okay for research purposes, but you know, for daily purposes, it's quite cumbersome because it's not just your A, B, C, D grading system of the ISHLT. It's much, much more scoring than that. Any questions to that one? How many people do transplants, lung transplants? Jeff, Michigan group, Henry.
We're just starting up again.
Okay, Henry is starting up again. Margaret is doing it.
Well, so Edmonton does it, and then we get their patients to follow.
Yeah. Okay.
We also do it in Jacksonville.
Yeah, you do quite a few. That's right. Yeah, so do you see RAS quite commonly in autopsies or in retransplants?
In expanded lungs, yes.
Yeah. I have to say, I only saw maybe two or three classic cases, but maybe we get more aware of that now and look for it more careful.
And as the paper says, most of the time it's mixed.
Okay, yeah. You know, the other question I would have for people, it's not based on this paper, but when you get your explants, how many samples do you take from your explants? So honestly, if we don't see anything out of the ordinary, we get one section from each lobe. I know from some groups, they take, for instance, three sections from each lobe. So what are you doing?
So in Florida, we take two sections from each lobe.
Two. Okay.
Will, do you know what it is for us?
Yeah, so it's one per lobe in the central part of the lobe, and then we take a peripheral section from each lobe too. So two per. I usually tell the residents, if you're going to take any extra, take another one of the lower lobes, because sometimes we just, and this is for the native ones that are coming out, is yep. What I mean. We don't really see right. That many second transplants. But in those, I would tell them to probably sample similarly.
Yep.
Yeah, relevant to your comment, Anya, I'm trying to think how many examples of CLAD I've seen here, and they've been very few and far between.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally agree with that point of this in its current format of how they have it here in the research setting. It's way too onerous to apply directly. They say it's scored per airway. Every single airway was scored separately.
Right. And then they take the mean of everything. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, let's see how that develops. Any other questions to that one? But thanks for sharing your experience with also how you sample the explants. that's quite helpful because there's so much variation between groups. Okay, so let's go to the next one. The next one is A Family Affair by Suster and Suster. The first and the last author is Suster. And this is entitled Inflammatory Giant Cell Carcinoma of the Lung, Clinical Pathologic Immunohistochemical and Next Generation Sequencing Study of 14 Cases. This is published in the American Journal of Surgical Pathology. And the aim was to describe a distinct variant of sarcomatoid carcinoma. They identified 14 cases from their pathology archives between 1980 and 2020, so over a 40-year period. And they performed IHC and next-gen sequencing using the Oncomine precision assay. For the clinical features, there is no sex predilection in these cases. The mean age was 57 years old, with a range of 42 to 73 cases to 73 years old. So they did not find these cases in very young patients. Seven patients were smokers. From the other seven patients, they had no smoking history. Most of these patients presented with cough and hemoptysis. All tumors were peripheral, mostly subpleural. Most of them were in the upper lobes. The mean tumor size was 4.6 centimeters, but they could be quite large, up to 9 centimeters. They were 10 wide, lobulated on the cut surface of the necrotic. All of these 14 patients underwent resection of the tumor with or without followed chemotherapy and or radiation. So let's go to the pictures here. Here's the first picture. As you can see, what was actually quite characteristic of all of these cases were discohesive tumor cells, and they were in an abundant inflammatory cell background, and these inflammatory cells were comprised of polymorphonuclear leukocytes, lymphocytes, plasma cells, and histiocytes, and focally they described microabscesses. They thought that the tumor cells resemble histiocytes, giant multi-lobated and multinuclear tumor cells, Reed-Sternberg-like cells, and cells that assemble anaplastic large cell lymphoma, which we can see here in figure number 2. And then they also had a few cells that had this raptoid look, so bringing up the differential diagnosis of SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumors. They also pointed out that some of these giant cells showed extensive emperipolysis, as you can appreciate here in figure 4. And then there was extensive necrosis, high mitotic activity. And in 6 cases, there was the classic focal transition to a minor component of either adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, encompassing 10 to 20% of the entire tumor. Now, in 11 of the 12 cases, they had a T stage, which was actually all over the board. Most of the cases, 8 cases, were either stage T1 or T2. 5 cases were high stage of either T3 or T4. Most of the cases did not have lymph node metastasis. Only one case had an N2 node and one case had an N3 node. And then 2 cases had metastasis, either M1A or M1B. All tumor cells were keratin positive with either A1A3 or CK8/18. All tumor cells were TTF1, NAPSIN, P40, CK5/6 negative, except for the foci of adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma. S100 were negative, was negative, and BRG1 was expressed in all of the cases. Ki-67 proliferation index was high, staining 50 to 80% of the tumor cells. Molecular was done in all cases, and they mainly found TP53 mutations in over half of the cases. And then they found pathogenic variants in KRAS. And interestingly, 2 of the cases had variants in G12C, which may be targetable. They also found rare EGFR mutations in FGFR1, GNA11, HRAS, PIK3CA, MET exon 14 skipping or RET rearrangement. And I think that was all found in just one case, or in one case each. The follow-up was available in 13 cases. 8 patients died of disease between 6 months and 8 years, with a mean of 2.7 years. 3 were alive without disease between 4 to 6 years. So basically, the differential diagnosis of this kind of tumor includes melanoma, sarcoma, large cell lymphoma, Hodgkin lymphoma, anaplastic large cell lymphoma, and SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumor. Although this goes out of the differential once the keratin is done. Seems to be an aggressive tumor, mainly in smokers, but there is maybe some potential for targeted therapy in a subset of these tumors. So they probably should undergo next-gen sequencing. What I would say as a critique to the paper is they only included cases that were resected. They did not include any non-resected cases. I probably would also, because of the inflammatory component, done an EBV. That was not done here. And they did not really compare the NGS data or PD-L1 with the usual sarcomatoid carcinomas. And they also did not perform carcinoma markers such as Claudin-4 or PCA, because I thought I probably would have done that, because these are all peripheral tumors. And I do think for some of them, maybe the differential of mesothelioma would come up. But anyway, any questions to that paper?
Anya, are they using the term inflammatory to describe a subset of what we've always known as giant cell carcinomas, or are they just adding that term for no particular reason? Like, is this what we've always known giant cell carcinoma to be, or are they using the word inflammatory to say this is a subset of giant cell carcinomas?
Well, that is a good question. So first, they wanted to really describe a variant of these tumors. Then in their discussion, they actually go on that even though giant cell carcinoma is a distinct, you know, term in the WHO, a pure giant cell carcinoma is only rarely seen. And they presented these cases as some examples of those.
Yeah.
But
okay.
I think, yeah.
They're just expanding on what's previously been published. They're not suggesting this is a unique subvariant.
At least that I did not get that out of their discussion, even though in the beginning they say they would like to have that as a variant. But
they mentioned in their discussion somewhere they think the inflammatory background component has been underplayed or kind of downplayed in the past. So they wanted to bring that up.
I mean, because we see that sort of phenomenon in other types of non-small cell lung carcinoma and don't separate them out based on that feature. Yeah. So I was just curious.
Right. Would have been my question to you. Do we really need a new category?
For something we almost never see? I don't think so.
Good.
It took four institutions to get 14.
Hasn't stopped us in the past. Well, not us collectively, but others.
All right. So if there are no other questions, let's go on to the next paper by Weisfurt and Moran from the MD Anderson group. And this is entitled Primary Extraskeletal Osteosarcomas of the Pleura, a Clinicopathological Immunohistochemical and Molecular Analysis of 4 Cases, published in Human Pathology. And the aim was to explore the clinicopathological IHC and molecular features of primary pleural extraskeletal osteosarcomas. And these osteosarcomas should not have any connection to the skeletal system. And actually to explore them in the differential diagnosis of mesothelioma with heterologous elements. They had 4 cases, and when they searched for their cases, they searched basically for spindle cell neoplasms with malignant osseous elements arising from the pleura, and they were all from the pathology files from MD Anderson. All of them were thoracoscopic biopsies, none of them apparently was a resection. They did IHC and they did FISH for CDK N2A. All of these patients were male with a mean age of 70 years, ranging from 63 to 78 years old. So again, no very young patients. They presented with chest pain, cough, and or shortness of breath. On imaging, three of the patients had pleural based masses. One of these three had also an associated pleural thickening. And the fourth case had just a diffuse pleural thickening without a dominant mass. All of the cases showed calcifications on imaging. None of the cases had known exposure to asbestos. One patient had a history of prostate carcinoma. So histologically, let's go to the figure here. Here's one of the figures. Histologically, they were all malignant spindle cell proliferations. You can also see here some mitotic activity. In one case, there was more pleomorphism, which is, I think, case D. No, they don't have it here. Okay, and then there was abundant osteoid matrix in all of them, which you can see here already in figure C, but much better here in figure three. And then as you can see in 3C, one of the cases actually had chondroplastic differentiation, and then there was also some myxoid changes. So basically, in the end, three of their cases were osteoplastic and one was a chondroplastic osteosarcoma. They performed SAT-B2 staining, but only in one of the cases, and it showed diffuse staining as shown here in figure 4A. So they did not test the other three tumors. All tumors were negative for keratin A1, A3, CK5/6, and then all bunch of other mesothelial markers. Also, they tested STAT6, which was negative. BAP1 expression was retained. They performed FISH for CDKN2A, and none of the cases had homozygous deletion. They had follow-up in only two of the cases. One patient died of disease 8 months after diagnosis. One patient was alive 2 months after diagnosis, but they did not know the disease status. So the authors argue in their discussion that the osteosarcoma diagnosis should be rendered for tumors with malignant osseous or cartilaginous differentiation after a comprehensive IHC and FISH analysis failed to support mesothelioma. Other studies actually argue that in the absence of keratin expression, the anatomic distribution will sort out meso versus osteosarcoma. I mean, if we go by that definition, then one of their cases probably should have been a mesothelioma because they didn't have a distinct mass in case number four. Then other studies have shown that patients with osteosarcoma can have a history of asbestos exposure. And I mean, that of course can be. Now, the authors of this paper argue that the distinction between osteosarcoma, extraskeletal osteosarcoma, and mesothelioma is important, even though they probably all have equally poor prognosis, but the treatments and managements may be different, but they don't really go into that. The authors also do not provide any cases of mesothelioma with heterologous elements for comparison. The follow-up is sparse to non-existent. And SAT-B2, I think, should have been stained in all of the cases because I think this marker may be actually helpful because it is supposedly negative in mesotheliomas, at least according to ImmunoQuery and looking at some of these papers. Also, they argue that FISH should be done for CDKN2A, but according to the literature, when I looked through the literature, homozygous deletion of CDKN2A has been reported in extraskeletal osteosarcomas. So I don't think the homozygous deletion of CDKN2A really helps in that distinction. Yeah, any questions to that paper?
I mean, it seems, as you pointed out in your final comments, that given their search strategy, they should have pulled up some mesotheliomas with heterologous elements, and it would have been useful to compare them, especially with reference to the SAT-B2. Second, I'm disappointed because I've basically felt if you see a small biopsy from something that has osteosarcomatous elements in a patient with diffuse pleural disease, you can pretty safely call it mesothelioma and move on. This paper suggests that that's probably not good advice, but I'm still skeptical.
Yeah, I was wondering about their case with the diffuse, you know, pleural thickening, but no distinct mass, and only a biopsy was used. So I'm not sure. But, you know, how many cases have you seen of mesothelioma with osteosa or with osteoid matrix? Because I'm not sure if I ever have seen a case.
I've seen a handful. They've all been keratin positive.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a few in our teaching set.
Mm-hmm. All right. Have you struggled with these cases? Have you ever thought about osteosarcoma?
No.
No, because of the keratin?
We didn't have anything new to say.
Okay.
I'll show him to Brandon and let him sort it out. You know, he has that nice soft tissue thoracic overlap. So you can just share him with Jen Boland and she can figure it out for you.
Okay.
All I'm not sure I can tell either, Henry. As Jeff said,
you're letting me down.
Now the truth comes to light.
We've seen a bunch too, and I have a very memorable one from, I think it was sent from the Middle East. We struggled and struggled on a couple different small biopsies because it just looked like osteosarcoma, and then they did a resection. There's obvious mesothelioma there. So I guess I'm skeptical. I don't know. I think the concept of extraskeletal osteosarcoma is a bit of a dying concept. And so I feel like this kind of goes against that to some degree, but I tend to like the common things to occur and have uncommon presentations, and that's just the mindset that I prefer. So I would tend to, my bias would tend to think that these are mesotheliomas with osteosarcomatous differentiation, but I don't know how you would sort that out.
I like
ZAPI2. I think its specificity is not very good. I mean, it's fine, but I've seen it be positive in things. I guess I just stopped ordering it because I ordered it a few times and it was positive and I didn't know what to do with it. So I stopped ordering it.
To me, that's kind of like, well, of course it's going to express ZAPI2 because it's osteoblastic and it's making osteoid matrix. It's like,
right.
It's CDX2 and a mucinous tumor. It doesn't really mean anything anymore when you see it like that. The non-GI side, it just tells you, well, yeah, it's mucinous. So of course it's expressing enteric markers. I think of it in the same way.
Well, I think ZAPI2 doesn't even help in the GI anymore.
That's right.
Not specific there. Well, great discussion. I wanted to point out two more papers here. One is on page 12. If the evening TV doesn't show any good movie, you may be able to read that paper because it's it brings the old dilemma out. It is from Giuseppe Pelosi and Bill Travis, head-to-head, should Ki-67 proliferation index be included in the formal classification of pulmonary neuroendocrine neoplasms? I don't want to spoil the result here of that review if you want to read it, but otherwise you can just read the conclusions of what I put in here. But I wanted to actually discuss or look into this paper here from the ISLC, from Spicer and colleagues. It's on page 9. This is entitled Neoadjuvant and Adjuvant Treatments for Early Stage Resectable Non-Small Cell Lung Carcinoma, Consensus Recommendations from the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer, published in JTO. Now, this is more clinical. But what I wanted to bring up is the key recommendation 12, which is the use of intraoperative frozen sectioning is recommended to assure complete resection and limited excessive parenchymal resection. And they overall had 19 recommendations and 18 of them achieved over 85% consensus. So this is what they called, this was one of the consensus recommendations. And why do I want to bring that up? Because of their definition of R0 status. And this is probably the current recommendation for R0 status, and I tried to actually find the definition of R0 status in non-small cell lung carcinoma, looking through the HACC, looking through the IASLC papers for the recommendation for the 8s and the 9s, TNM and so on. I couldn't really find a true definition, but maybe it's just me. But their definition entitles, all three resection margins have been proven microscopically, including not only bronchial, but also venous and arterial stumps, periponchial soft tissue, any peripheral margin near the tumor or of additional resected tissue. Systematic nodal dissection in its wider form or lobe-specific systematic nodal dissection must have been performed and proven negative. Now it comes, no extra capsular extension of tumor in lymph nodes removed separately or in those at the margin of the main lung specimen. And then the highest mediastinal node that has been removed must be negative. So my question to you is, how are we supposed to look for extra capsular extension of tumor in lymph nodes when they only take out bits or fragments of lymph nodes? And then the other question is, do you all actually sample venous and arterial stump margins at time of frozen? I'm just curious.
At time of frozen? No.
Yeah.
No, we do the bronchial margin at frozen. We do the others on permanence.
So you do them, but just not on frozen?
Right.
Okay. Any others?
Why does extra capsular extension preclude an R0 status if the R0 status isn't staged but clarity of margins? You can have extra capsular invasion of a node with a clear margin.
Yeah.
Well, I don't get why that's conflated with positive margin.
Well, for instance, another requirement for R0, and they don't have it in here, is a certain number of lymph nodes. And if you don't have that certain number of lymph nodes, then it's actually an R undefined. So, but yeah.
I mean, you're right. I mean, this, you know, we tend to think of margins on the main tumor, not on lymph node status. I mean, is this a trend in other organ systems as well? Do we know?
I don't know. That's why I asked the question. I mean, it seems like it conflates margin
right.
status, which is what R is supposed to signify, with stage.
Exactly. We're mixing apples and oranges here.
Yeah.
I think it's an excellent time to retire. That's my advice.
Is this your last journal club, Jeff?
No, I have December.
Okay. All right.
Can I ask, does extra capsular extension change the staging in any way?
Well, it will now if we use this. Well, I don't know. Now,
just the R. It would just the
R thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it changes the letters you use.
But can you even look for extra nodal extension if you get just the fragments?
No, you can't.
Right.
That's.
Well, I mean, you might get really lucky and see it, but mostly you wouldn't.
Yeah. Huh.
I mean, you can see it sometimes, right? I mean, if you see it going through the capsule, or you see a lot of fat or something.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
So are you going to all adopt this like today? I'm just asking.
I'm glad the surgeons don't attend this. I don't want to do frozens on stumps.
So, Margaret, do you sample arterial and venous stumps for perm?
For
I'm just asking because we know also for perm.
For permanent.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, yeah.
Yeah, but not for frozen.
No.
The Michigan group, what are you doing?
I do both on frozen, yeah. And frankly, I don't know why. Usually they ask. Mm-hmm. They just say bronchovascular margin. So I just sample the whole area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did ever anyone see a venous or arterial margin positive?
I don't think I've ever seen one.
Never.
Or a
Except
bronchial
for maybe
margin,
it's
for that matter, in a peripheral tumor. That's an anachronistic practice for which I doubt there's much evidence.
Yeah, good point.
I've seen one on a squamous carcinoma that was close.
One bronchial margin or one vascular margin?
Well, it actually wasn't in the vessel. It was right next to the vessel.
Okay, so soft tissue. So, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've only ever seen tumor on those sections in lymphatics around everything else, which is, you know, not surgically removable anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, great discussion. Thank you for attending Journal Club. And
happy Thanksgiving.
Have a good
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving,
everyone.
That was fantastic.
Thanks, Anya.
Thank you.